lesson 48, in case you want to go back over it again at some point. So let's just take a breath a minute and remember, the Course in Miracles doesn't have anything to do with, you know, what we already believe necessarily. So you don't have to believe it in order to use it. And that's what I love about it. So just because we're saying this, don't put any pressure on yourself to necessarily believe it, and then it'd be easier for you to believe it. There's nothing to fear. The Course says there's nothing to fear, simply states a fact. But it's not a fact to those who believe in fears. But fears are not facts. In truth, there's nothing to fear. It's very easy to recognize that there's nothing to fear, but it's very hard to recognize that there's nothing to fear for those who want their fears to be real. So we're going to repeat this idea to ourselves as often as possible. There's nothing to fear, which is the same as saying there's nothing to be afraid of. And we can use the idea that there's nothing to be afraid of in any situation, and we can do it with our eyes closed, and we can do it with our eyes open. But take a moment, whenever possible, during the day, to repeat slowly to yourself that there is nothing to fear. It's particularly important to tell yourself immediately there is nothing to fear. Should anything disturb your peace of mind, tell yourself immediately there is nothing to fear. If you feel fear, the presence of fear is a sure sign that you're trusting in your own strength, separate from the Creator. If you feel fear, it just means you're trusting in your own strength, on your own, by yourself. The awareness that there is nothing to fear shows that somewhere in your mind, though not necessarily in a place in your mind that you recognize right now, that you have actually remembered God. And if you feel like there is nothing to fear, then that means you're letting the strength of God take its place in your awareness. The instant you're willing to let the strength of God take its place in your awareness, there is indeed nothing to fear. There is nothing to fear. There is nothing to fear. There's 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 nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing to be afraid of. You don't have to believe that idea. You don't have to accept that idea. You don't have to welcome that idea. You might feel some resistance to that idea. You're not asked to judge that idea, but if you use that idea, especially when something disturbs you, you will eventually see that that idea is true. There is nothing to fear. There's nothing to fear. So if you have fear, or you have worry, or you have some kind of concern about something, what is that a sure sign of? Anybody? If you do feel afraid, according to the Course, what is that a sure sign of?
Do it on your own.
Thank you.
Separation.
He says, the Course isn't denying that we have fear. It's just telling, well, it just means you think you got to somehow or another on your own do it. And you're trusting in your own strength. And he says that it just means you feel inadequate to handle the situation. And that's why you feel concerned, because you think it's up to you by yourself, and then you may not feel like you're up to handling the situation, the circumstance. He says, that's why we're afraid, you know. A child tends not to be afraid when a child feels like they have their parent there to protect them. So it's not the reason why the child isn't afraid is because the child isn't trusting in the strength of itself. The child is trusted in the strength of the parent. We, because of the age of our body, we forget that we are still the child of a greater parent. And just because we're adults, then we think at a certain point, you're supposed to no longer depend on a strength greater than your own. As a matter of fact, the Course says that that's what we consider to be a sign of adulthood, or that we really have our act together. It's when we don't need anybody for anything except ourselves. And the Course teaches that's the most ludicrous idea that a person could instill in themselves. But it's what the ego, the separated self, is all about. It's all about, let me do it by myself. So last week we were talking about how is healing accomplished. and I'm going to finish up on that section. And on Wednesday, because we have a smaller number of people, I'm very much open to discussion and answering questions, but I just like to ask that you try to focus on directing the questions toward a better understanding of the section that we're reading, so that the questions won't be a distraction from learning what we're hearing. So I really, really try to keep from going off on tangents into other things. So if I read it back in, I'm not trying to be rude or anything. I'm just trying to keep us focused. I'll do a quick review. The last week, How is Healing Accomplished was the section. It's on page 17 in the teacher's manual. And he says, and I want to emphasize that when we talk about healing from the Course, we're talking about the undoing of fear. We're talking about the releasing of the fear. And we're talking about any form of lack of peace. So the Course isn't just talking about physical illness, even though it includes that. It's talking about any time we don't feel the peace of God, the Course considers that as being mental illness or sickness. Based on that definition, there's a lot of sickness going on. Yeah, right? So the first thing that it says, the first point is that he says it's impossible to have a healing unless you understand what the sickness is for. So if a person is in a situation that's causing them conflict, he's saying you're not going to have a healing until you know what the conflict is for. And he says that you're going to have a healing as soon as you no longer see any value in the pain, in the conflict, and in the sickness. So the healing doesn't happen just because of medicine or therapy or jogging or going to workshops or reading or whatever. The healing happens as soon as you no longer see any value in the lack. That's when the abundance can come. You no longer see a value in the sickness. That's when the health can come. You no longer see a value in loneliness. That's when the union comes. So the point that it's making is that somehow or another there's a payoff in the condition that you can't get rid of. Like all of us have those patterns that it looks like no matter what we do, we keep that pattern. There is a payoff in that pattern. And there's something about that pattern that brings you more feelings of safety than being without that pattern, even though it looks like the pattern is bugging you. So the next thing it says that healing occurs in exact proportion to which the valuelessness of sickness is concerned. And it also says that, we said last week, that once you decide to be healed, then special agents are ministered to you, but the special agents just give form to your choice. In other words, I decide to have a peaceful relationship, then the workshops, the counseling, the conversation, the communication, the vacation, whatever it is we do to get to the point that we have peace again happens. I decide that I'm going to be more peaceful, then all the meditation techniques and the seminars and the classes and the books show up. In other words, it's the thing that helps give form to our desire. It shows up the once you've decided that you really want that desire. So the most important thing is to decide that you want the healing to begin with. And that's what I see my classes as being about. Supporting people in making the decision for their healing, because it's out of the decision that everything happens. Many people do it just the opposite. They think that the thing is going to happen, the person's going to show up, then I'm going to be loving. You know, something happens on the outer, then I'll decide to be happy. That's backwards. First I decide to have peace, then the things on the outer start to help me support that goal. And then physical things or people or situations come into our life, he says, to give form to that desire. But you don't actually have to have those things to give form to that desire. But for most people, that's too big of a leap. And so it looks like we need to go through these what we call stages of healing. Because really, if what we're shooting for ultimately is peace of mind, and peace of mind comes from a mental attitude or perspective, there are people, actually I've met people in wheelchairs that's happier than people I see walking around with a healthy body.
Absolutely.
You know, and if a person that's in a wheelchair that can't move their limbs, those two boys, for instance, who were hit by a car and they lost both their legs. It's two teenage boys. Their attitude is unbelievable in terms of how they've chosen to still be optimistic about their life. And I know so many of us have food to eat, clothes, cars, healthy body, and all we do is bitch all the time about everything. And so we see that peace has nothing to do with the outer, because you have the food, the clothes, the shelter, and everything. So what's making the person be unhappy? It's what they're telling themselves. This is the decision they're making. So there's some kind of payoff in always being miserable. And the court says it's because we have been taught that life is conflict and that peace is death. That's why when people die, we say rest in peace. You know, so the court says at a subconscious level, we don't realize it, but we got a vested interest in keeping conflict going because that's what we think life is. So the minute a person starts to feel a lot of peace, it actually, for many people, brings up fear. That one, and when the shoe is going to fall, when is something going to go wrong? You know what I mean? So there's a part of us that actually is afraid of peace. He's saying it's actually afraid of happiness. And it feels like, you know, that if we got conflict, I'm alive. I'm going through so much stuff, I must be alive. So unhappy people, they make themselves feel alive through drama. Happy people, they allow themselves to feel alive through extension and creativity and joy and union. So miserable people need drama. That's why soap operas are so popular. I watched about 2 or 3 minutes of it. It amazes me how much drama they can come up with in 5 minutes, you know. And and the thing is, to me, it's just an exaggerated version of what we do all the time, you know. But the thing that's interesting about people who are purely in their fear or in their ego, like you see on the soap opera, one thing I like about them is nobody bites their tongue. You know, everybody says exactly what they think about anybody and everybody that they're around. You know, they don't like something, they say it. They don't like the person, they say, you know, I don't like you, I don't trust you, da da da. But sometimes people who are trying to be nice, New Thought people, like us, we have a tendency to not be honest about our feelings a lot of times and go for what we think we ought to say or should say rather than be honest about what we're really feeling. You know, it's hard-pressed to find a New Age person to walk in a room and say, you know, I hate my dad, I'm mad at everything, and I wish everybody just died. They're not gonna say that. They're going to say, how's everything going? Fine. How's everything going? Great. Everything's good. You know, are you angry? No, I'm not really angry. Just a little uncomfortable, you know. So the course is teaching us that when you do that, you're actually making yourself afraid because the way that you're behaving is opposite to the way that you're really thinking, and that actually increases fear instead of decreasing fear. It has to be better to say, you know, right now I'm not feeling peace about whatever. But so I try to be honest as much as I can, as often as I can, even though I don't always pull it off either. You know, if I did, I wouldn't be here. If we all had it together, we wouldn't be here. Okay, so we all the same. So the court says that I'm gonna start at paragraph 3. I'm gonna do the last 2 paragraphs. It's on page 18. But he says that if you say you have no more use for this, there's no form of sickness that wouldn't be cured instantly. Isn't that a heck of a statement? If I was to say I have no more use for this, it would be healed instantly. Didn't say it next week. It said instantly. So the next 2 paragraphs says this. What is the single requisite for this shift in perception? It's simply this: the recognition that sickness is of the mind and has nothing to do with the body. What does this recognition that sickness is of the mind and has nothing to do with the body cost? Well, recognizing that sickness is of the mind and has nothing to do with the body, it costs the whole world. You see, for the world will never again to appear to rule the mind. For with this recognition, what recognition that sickness is of the mind and has nothing to do with the body? With this recognition is responsibility placed where responsibility belongs, not with the world, but on him who looks on the world and sees it as it's not. The person looks on what he chooses to see, no more and no less. The world does nothing to you, you only thought it did. Nor do you do anything to the world, because you are mistaken about what the world is. Herein is the release from guilt and sickness both, for guilt and sickness are one. Yet to accept this release, the insignificance of the body must be an acceptable idea. With this idea, what idea? The insignificance of the body. Is pain forever gone? But with this idea goes also all confusion about creation. Doesn't this follow necessity? Place, cause, and effect in their true sequence in one respect, and the learning will generalize and transform the world. The transfer value of one true idea has no end or limit. The final outcome of this lesson is the remembrance of God. What do guilt, sickness, pain, and disaster all mean now? Having no purpose, they are gone. And with them also go all the effects they seem to cause. Cause and effect but replicate creation. Seen in their proper perspective, without distortion and without fear, they reestablish heaven. Sometimes when you're listening to the course, you can hear it for a little while, and then by the time you hear about 5 minutes, you just go zone out. Anybody notice that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know why?
Why?
Because you don't want to hear
it. You know
it.
Why you zone out?
No,
you don't want to hear it.
Thank you. It's just that simple. The ego doesn't want to hear it.
Oh.
The ego doesn't want to hear it. The old man doesn't want to hear it. It doesn't want to hear the truth because it'll be gone. That old identity would be out the door if you really heard it. So what it does is it just says the same thing over and over again in different ways. So let's go back. Okay, so I notice I'm in a world where it looks like there does seem to be pain and suffering. But I'm also in a world where the insignificance of the body is not an acceptable idea. You know what I'm saying? It's like what I've noticed about the course is every time it gives me an answer, it's always something that's the opposite of what I normally think. But it would make sense that if I wanted to be in a condition opposite to the way I normally am, I'd have to hear something that's opposite to what I normally hear. Right? So it says that if you were to realize that the problem that you're having has nothing to do with your body, that it really has something to do with your mind, he says, well, that would cost you the whole world you see, because most people base their whole world on the idea that there are things happening to them outside of them that has nothing to do with them, that they have no control over. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you accepted the idea that your experience was a reflection of your mind, then that's going to cost you the whole world you see, because you can never again look at it as if you're a victim of the world. So for some people, that's too big of a leap, because there's a lot of confidence in being a victim. If you're a victim, you don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So victim is really appealing. You know, I could just blame you, say, if you change that, I'd be happy. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to own anything about my experience. I just need to just sit back and wait for somebody to come treat me the way I want to be treated. So the course is trying to get us to see that the world isn't really doing anything to me, and I'm not really doing anything to it. If your peace comes from your mind and my peace comes from my mind, then I can't take your peace away and you can't take my peace away. So the truth is, you aren't doing anything to me. I'm doing it to myself. You could call me out of my name right now, but just because you called me out of my name, I do not have to feel bad about it. I do not have to get upset about it. So if I do get upset, it's really me upsetting me. It's not you upsetting me. It's me upsetting me. So therefore, you didn't do anything to me.
It's taking a lot of responsibility.
It's taking a lot of responsibility. But then, I love that, because the only person I got any control over is me. So I'd much rather put the responsibility on the one person I do at least have a little influence over. Not a whole lot, but a little influence over. But I certainly don't have none over any of you. So the minute that I accepted that I was the creator of my experience, then I no longer lived in the world that everybody around me lived in, who saw themselves as being victims. Then I began to attract more people to me who also wanted to believe that they were the creator of their experience. Then I started to have much more peaceful relationships, because you can't do nothing but have more peaceful relationships with people who take responsibility for their own happiness. So I eventually started to move into a different world. Why? Because your circle of friends, they are your world. So therefore, they're the people who really influence you the most, of your most intimate associates, not the strangers around you. So really, for most people to have a happy world, they only need to change 5 or 6 people. or their mind about 5 or 6 people. Think about it. If you really were to think about it, if somebody said they're having a problem with relationships, they're usually talking about under 5 people. Usually they're talking about 1. And because of the relationship that they're having with that one person, they turn around and project it on their whole life and say, my life sucks. And it's not your life sucks. Your job does. That's not your whole life. You see what I'm saying? Or you upset with your mama, and then you might be upset with your cousin. That's 2 people. That leaves billions of people, literally, that you're not in conflict with. So the truth is, if you were looking at it correctly, you should be feeling good about yourself, because you're down to the last 2 or 3 people. Everybody else in the world is cool with you. You're just down about 5 or 10. That's really something to be, that's really a good thing as far as I can see. Then what happens is that you eventually get to the point that you're not in conflict with anybody and you still feel conflict. And that really blows your mind. Because then you realize the conflict was always in your mind and had nothing to do with anybody else. And the other people were what you used to fool yourself into thinking that it wasn't in your mind. So as you become enlightened, you're just letting go of the people or perceptions of people that you're using to deceive yourself about where your conflict is coming from. That's why as long as I can point to a lot of people who upset me, then that reinforces the idea that the conflict isn't in my mind. Because see, I can point to the boss and I can point to the child and I can point, you see what I mean? But when you start doing your spiritual work, you're going to find that they're going to start to drop away and the conflict's going to start to drop away, but you may find you're still not particularly feeling zippity-doo-dah. And he says that's when you come upon the most powerful place in the path. It's when you realize it's you hate. Mm-hmm. And he said, now some people, when they realize they just hate themselves, they get depressed and want to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. Then other people realize that, oh, that means nobody outside of me was doing it, and it means God wasn't doing it. So now I can turn to God, and now I can turn to people around me to support me. One person looks at it like, oh, then I don't have a bunch of enemies. I do have a creator that's not against me, so I can go to my creator. Other people just get depressed and feel like, oh, it's just me. I hate myself. I just need to take myself out. I'm a no good person. Because, of course, you always got two alternatives. So you get to the point you realize you have a real choice. He says you don't realize you have a real choice until the alternatives that you're choosing between are different. So now I can see... If I'm trying to think of the next person and the next thing outside of myself that's going to make me happy, the course is you're not really making a new choice. Choosing different aspects of the same thing isn't a choice. But if you go, oh, I'm going to choose to change my mind to allow myself to be happy, or I can continue to look for everybody else to make me happy, then that's your real two choices. But if I'm trying to choose among the people outside myself that's going to make me happy, that isn't a new choice. You see what I mean? If I'm unhappy on this job and I really think it's the people on the job, so I quit that job and I get another job, I really haven't made a different choice. If I go into the new job, also expecting them to be the one to make me happy, and it has nothing to do with me. Don't it make so much sense that it does make you mad sometimes?
Yeah.
It's so simple that sometimes it just kind of gets you, you know. And so the Course, and this was another thing that I thought was really cool, was that Course said that guilt and sickness are the same. That was deep. You know, I like to write stuff. Guilt and sickness are the same. So if I'm feeling sick, I'm really feeling guilty. If I'm feeling lack, I'm really feeling guilty. If I feel attacked, I'm really feeling guilty. If I feel lonely, I'm really feeling guilty. If I'm feeling unhappy, I'm really feeling guilty. If I'm feeling depressed, I'm really feeling guilty. That's not what people usually say. If they fall down and hurt themselves, they don't go, dog, I was feeling guilty. They say, I tripped over the sidewalk. Or I stumbled. See, when your mind begins to change, you immediately go to the mental cause of what you're going through instead of going to the physical cause of what you're going through. The form my guilt took was I stumbled and I fell.
I had that exact thing happen, and I knew it. And it was like, I had a bad bike accident a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and I fell off my bike and really got a concussion. But right before I fell off my bike, what was going through my head was, oh, I should have done, it was a business thing. Mm-hmm. I should have done it this way, and I didn't do it this way, and I was feeling guilt. And bam. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like...
I failed one time about it, I guess a couple of years ago, and feeling so long, it freaked me out. But it was so fast I couldn't catch myself. I was walking, because I thought you could always pretty much catch yourself, you know what I'm saying? So I tripped, and I went... It was just like that, and I brushed my... nose and head and stuff. And right before that, I had just done something I felt guilty about. You know, and I knew I was punishing myself. You know, and it was like, wow, that was just an instant. Not that the thing I did was wrong, I thought it was.
Yeah.
And I always emphasize it to people. When I say that guilt is a request for punishment, I'm not saying the thing you did was wrong.
No.
You believed the thing you did was wrong.
Yeah.
Because if you feel guilty before you do it and you feel afraid before you do it, then you know you feel guilty before you do it.
And then the ego says, well, you just go, you just blast past your fear, and you just do it anyway. You know, and that's what the ego teaches you. Truth teaches you just the opposite. If as much as possible, you find a place of inner peace and act from inner peace. You don't act from fear, you act from peace. But the ego goes, oh no, you're just being chicken, so you just go ahead and you just go ahead and do that, and you just blast past that fear, you know. And the truth is, you're much more likely to do something correctly from a space of peace than from a space of fear, because fear distorts your perception. You know, if I was going to do a high dive and I had given myself peace about the high dive, I'd probably have a safer high dive than I was going, ah! You know, so common sense would tell you that fear does not give you the optimum position to be in when you're doing something. But the average person doesn't take the time to go choose for peace, because they think peace is the effect of something instead of peace being the cause. You know, if I do the high dive right and live through it, I have more peace about doing high dive. So I'll scare myself, and then after I scare myself, if it works out, then I believe I can do it. You see, and so the truth says just the opposite. You choose for peace first, then jump off the diving board. You know, and that would make a lot more sense. So what we need to do then, rather than work so much on the form of what we think the problem is, we need to get clear that it's a form of guilt. Okay? And then it goes on to say, if you want to accept your release, he says what? The insignificance of the body must be an acceptable idea. Now, remember that in the teacher's manual and in the text, this is a theoretical foundation. This is just telling you, this is just giving you an overview of what the course is trying to achieve. It has nothing to do with us being able to do it. Okay? The workbook is about the practical application of the ideas. Okay? So when you hear what we're going to be like, don't compare yourself to that and then make yourself feel bad because right now you can't feel like the body is insignificant. You see what I mean? Because the ego will go, oh God, if I got to look at the body being insignificant, I can just hang it up. I'll never make it, you know. No, but if you do this process, all the insignificance of the body means is that you'll put the body in its proper perspective. That's all it means. It won't be your God. It'll be part of your experience in the physical world. It won't be your... See, the body is the God. You know, you had your hand up first.
Well, I was going to just ask, with the insignificance of the body, that means basically that we are more consciousness?
Yeah, exactly.
We want to be more consciousness, filled with more consciousness and less body.
Right.
But we are inside this body.
Exactly.
Behind these eyes are.
Our body, the Course says our body is our medium of communication, joining, creating, sharing in this plane. You know, just like your car is your way of getting around. And you know you take care of your car if you want to continue to have transportation, right? So actually, when you see your body as a medium of expression, you actually take better care of it than you would if you thought your body was you. If I don't like myself, what's the first thing I'm going to abuse? My body. Through the way I eat, through the way I act, what I do with it. Because I think I am it. And if I don't like me, I don't like my body. It kind of goes like that. But if I realize I'm more than my body, and that my body is a vehicle for me to function in this plane, then I look at it like I need to take care of it so that I can take care of my business. See the difference in it? Yeah. So the Course, people think the Course is anti-body, and the Course keeps saying it's anti-pain. Not anti-special relationships, not anti-body, but anti-pain. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just took my grandson to a gym, you know, and there were all these bodybuilders there. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the body, and I'm thinking, okay. And two of them were getting married, the two big bodybuilders were getting married, and I was thinking, ooh, I wonder how that all, you know, ego and that would work out. Because I would think that you would be so ego-centered if you were a bodybuilder.
Unless you were a conscious bodybuilder. See, a conscious bodybuilder would be simply someone who was just trying to take better care of their vehicle of expression.
But
the average
building goes beyond just taking care of. I mean, it's.
Yeah, but to me, it's sort of like, can you? It's a difference between like Liberace, for those who are old enough. And in a regular person that plays a piano. You know what I'm saying? It's like he's not being more ego because he's so skilled. You know, so to me, I look at the bodybuilder as just being the Liberace of the body. You know, they just try to take their body. You know, but the main thing is the body is neutral. So what determines his consciousness? Wouldn't it be how he used it and what he used his body for?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? We would have to get to know him to know that.
Yeah.
But just because he's a bodybuilder doesn't necessarily mean he's unconscious. Even though we are in a society that teaches us that. You know, it's almost like if your body is good, you are good. Or if your body looks good, you are good. So we judge a lot by appearance. So to me, I've watched male friends in my life who were very handsome and also happened to have a lot of wealth and also had a lot of physical things like a big pretty house and a pretty car. And I would watch their things totally seduce women. They didn't have to say anything, and the woman would go to bed with him or throw themselves at him or anything because he looked good, he had security, what looked like security, and I saw that for the average woman that he would meet anyway, and even that I met. Now, I'm not talking about the consciously evolving woman, but I noticed that security is the greatest seduction a man can present to the average woman.
But that's a biological thing, don't you think?
Well, that's what Coase means when it says we terms like instincts, reflexes, and the like attempts to endow the body with non-mental motivators. So that's what's happening right there. You attempted to say because it's biological, it's not mental. But the desire for security is also a mental act, you know, because there are women who don't feel like they need a man for security. And so, therefore, they don't let a man seduce them out of security. So, from a Coase perspective, it wouldn't be biological. From a Coase perspective, everything that happens on the physical has its root in some type of an idea or a concept or the mind. And the things that are, and the ideas that are the most programmed and the ideas that are the most mass consciousness is nothing but ideas that a group of us all agree on. And so at a soul level, what we look at a lot of times is biological stuff or instinctual stuff or just deep subconscious beliefs that have been nurtured over millennia. Mm-hmm. So the point that I'm making, though, is that for the average man, it's just the body. The man gets seduced by the body. And it looks like the female ego gets seduced by security. There are always exceptions, but that looks like that's the general rule. So therefore, the person isn't falling in love with the person. They're falling in love with the appearance. And that's what Coase is saying, that we're in a world of appearances, and it defines appearances as illusions. Because appearances is just, that's just the way it looks. That's just the way it looks, but it isn't necessarily the way it is. I can look handsome and be a serial killer. So just because I look good doesn't make me good. And I could come in here looking like a bum and be a very loving spiritual person, but I probably wouldn't get a lot of phone numbers. The only person that would give me their phone number would be the person who had the capacity to look beyond appearances. And as you grow up spiritually, that's who you're most interested in. That's how you can always tell the difference between more or less a spiritually mature person and a person that's a spiritual adolescence. A person that's still a spiritual adolescence is much more concerned with the outer. As you mature in your spiritual growth, you become much more about the content than the form. It's much more important to you about what's going on in the inside than the outside. So that's the difference between an awake being and an asleep being. Mm-hmm.
But doesn't it have to do with energy too? I mean, there's the feminine energy and then there's the masculine energy, and if those two energies come together, then it creates an even bigger energy. So I'm just like,
we're talking about another level. We're talking about the level behind what even created the masculine energy and the feminine energy. Everything, even the whole idea of masculine energy and physical energy, originated in thought. The Coase's point is that everything originated in the mind. Everything originated as idea. So even feminine and masculine had to have an idea that created that idea. So the Coase is trying to take us to the causative level, instead of the effect level. So when you think masculine and feminine, when you think masculine and feminine, that's still at the effect level. That's still the effect of the thought of masculine and feminine. It still is the result of an idea. But I would invite you to think of this in terms of the insignificance of the body, and getting the body in the proper perspective will heal you. Or to think in terms of the fact that when you say you have no more use for anything that's bothering you, then it'll heal. See, all of the theoretical issues, the Course defines as delaying maneuvers to keep you from actually applying the idea. You see what I'm saying? So that's how it gets us. You know, it's like, because I can't prove, like we could kind of debate this, but because it's something that we're debating, that's how I know it's a trick. You know what I'm saying? It's like the Course got me on that. He says theoretical issues are delaying maneuvers. Mm-hmm. Like if we got in a conversation about reincarnation, or we got into a conversation about whether there's a heaven or whether there's a hell. Anything that we can't do right now, the Course considers to be a delaying maneuver. So what could we do right now? Well, right now we could consider that my thought is what's behind my reality. That the way I'm looking at things right now has to do with my thought. Everybody can pretty much agree with that, right? We could all agree right now that there might be a value in something that we're going through. And because of that value, we're hanging on to that. We all could agree that what we're perceiving right now is basically our interpretation. You see what I'm saying? So everything that's real, the Course says, you can always pretty much agree on it, see it right now. And then it encourages us to move away from whatever it is that's theoretical, because it claims that once you get to the truth, it will the experience of the truth will clear up all theoretical issues. And so you end up getting the answer to that. But what's going to end up is that you're going to realize I am you and you are me and we are one. That's where everything is going to probably end up at. So I'm not discouraging comments. I just want to share what the Course says about it so that we can stay on top of it. I'm going to start doing very soon what I call advanced mind training classes. Not very long workshops, but there'll be like, you know, 4 or 5 hours or something that I do on Saturdays, maybe once a month or something. But there's a lot of stuff that I want to cover and share that I can't do in an hour. And plus that, I want to create a community of people that are working with me that are going deeper and deeper and deeper, that we all get to know each other so we can go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. I have a need for that. I want to go deeper than I'm able to go in an hour, 3 times a week. And I'm sure that there are other people that want to do the same thing. And I'm going to find out over the next few weeks who they are. We're going to get together at least once a month, and we're going to do that. And I'm going to make it reasonable enough to do it so it wouldn't be a hardship for people to do it on a regular basis. But there's another level that I need to go to in my spiritual growth, and I know that there are other people that want to do the same thing. And I'm going to find out who they are.
So it won't be just a drop-in?
No. In the sense that what will happen is the people who want that level, you'll find that they're going to end up being basically the same people. That's what always happens. Anybody can come that wants to come, but you're going to find that when there's a financial investment and a time investment, there's only certain kinds of people that will do those two things.
They're really committed
people. They're the only ones who will make an investment,
yeah.
and who will take the time. And I feel like people are scratching the surface of what I know about the Course in Miracles after 30 years of sharing, and other things. And I need to remember it too. And so, to me, this is all like, this is like me teasing myself 3 times a week and I can't take it anymore. Really. A lot of people pat themselves on the back, maybe handle an hour of the Course once a week. But for me, it's like an appetizer that I never get to the main meal, because by the time I get warmed up, I'd be darned if I'm not looking at this thing going, okay, I got to wind it down because everybody got to be out of here in 10 minutes or so. Plus, there's a magical thing that happens after a couple of hours. The ego kind of like goes away. And then you start to hear it in a way you think you're hearing it now, but you hear it at a whole nother level if we have more time. And I want to do that, so we can move faster, you know. Yeah. So if you're one of those people that might be interested in being a part of something like that, before you go, you got to just pass it around while we're doing this. It's not. It's my way of knowing that you're interested. And then when I decide on the dates and stuff like that and how I'm going to do it, then I'll make sure I let you know about it. So you'd be like, make first choice about it. Because my greatest joy is awakening. It's deep. Okay. So I just need your name, the phone number, and email, or if you got email. Then in the last paragraph, he talks about the once you accept the insignificance of the body, he says, then what will happen? You'll be released, right? Then the next paragraph, he says, what's the main thing in that paragraph? To me, it's where he says, place cause and effect in their true sequence in one respect, and the learning will generalize and transform the world. The transfer value of a true idea has no end and no limit. So what that simply means is, if it's true, it applies to everything. If it's not, it applies to specific things. Isn't that a trip? I mean, that's the way he describes it. He says truth always has generalizability. So if it's the truth, it's always true for everybody. If it's of the ego or the separation, it's always, he calls it specific. You know, how do I know that a pencil is ultimately an illusion? Because I can't do everything with a pencil. I can only write with it, basically. But the idea that my thought is creating my perception of something, I can apply that to every single solitary thing in my life. My perception of this pencil is determining my response to it. My perception of you is determining my response to you. So if it's the truth, see how you apply it to everything. Mm-hmm. And that's how you can tell. But if it's specific, that's what really creates a problem when it comes to love. Because love is something that we think is specific. And the Course is saying that is not love. And that's our problem. Is that is specialness. That is not love. And if you could tell the difference between specialness and love, your relationships would go better. There's a world of difference between me telling you you're special to me. And you're more special to me than everyone in here. And I treat you more special than anyone in here. And you agree to treat me more special than anyone in here. And that's our agreement, that we want to treat each other more special than anyone in here. Then you and I are going to have peace with each other. Because we're in agreement about how we want to treat each other. But if I say I'm going to love everyone in here, then it's just the opposite of what I just did with her. Then that means that I'm going to be responding and looking at everyone equally, which means I want peace for everyone equally. I want freedom for everyone equally. So we have to learn to actually reach that level of consciousness. And the Course says the way that you do it is you don't necessarily try to go out and treat everybody physically equally, because it's not talking about that level. It's talking about a perceptual level. Okay? But it also means, but as far as treating, I need to treat her. I would need to treat her the way that the Course is teaching that you treat somebody you love. What does that mean? That means I appreciate her fully. It means I respect her fully. It means I do not attack her. It means that I feel united with her. It means that I support her joy. In other words, I'm going to treat her the way I should treat everybody. And then she becomes the symbol of my love for everybody. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Because I can't treat everybody physically the same, and I can't physically be with everybody. But I can take the people in my life that are special to me and apply these principles to them. And when you do that, it will automatically transfer to everybody else. You know why? Because you already let everybody else be. You already let everybody else be. Actually, what you're trying to do is get to the point that you treat the people that are special to you as well as you treat the people you don't know. Isn't that wild? You know what I'm saying? Because you don't care what I did last night. You don't care who I slept with or didn't sleep with. You don't care what I ate or didn't eat. You don't care. And I could do whatever I tell you my goal is. You all would just go, Chris, nice. But if I was special to you, you feel like you need to have a say in that. And you would, and what you had to say about that would probably be based on whether or not what I was saying was going to cause you to lose your specialness or not. So really the people that are most special to us at first are actually the ones we treat with the least amount of real love, but we treat them very special. See the difference? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what the Course is trying to teach us, that specialness isn't love, but specialness can be used to take you to love by just taking the special person and starting to do what? Do the right thing. It's just basically that old do the right thing with the person. So if she tells me something that's really important to her, if I really loved her, then I would support her in doing what really made her happy, even if it wasn't according to my script, if I loved her. But she might lose her specialness. You know what I mean? You know, because the specialness is a bargain. Now, how special I treat you, now that's going to have to do with whether or not you do some of the stuff I want you to do. All right, now you're going to stop doing what I want you to do because you want to be happy. I was okay. Now, I love you, but you might not be as special to me. See the difference? Why? Because the specialness is a bargain. Love isn't a bargain. So at some point on the spiritual path, a person has to make the choice between love and specialness. And what they'll find out is when they choose love, they actually are treated more special than they ever were treated when they were trying to be special. Because guess what? She's not going to run across guys every day that's going to say, what do you really want? How can I support you? And what do you really feel? And what do you really think? And I really want you to be happy. And you're not here just to act out my script. That's going to make me special. Because she's not going to go out and meet that with every guy that she goes out to meet. You see what I'm saying? So when you start practicing the truth, even though the goal really isn't specialness, you end up being the most special person in most of the people's lives you know. Because they'll remember you. They go, you know, it's something about you that's really different. You know, when I said something that you didn't like, you didn't attack me and you didn't try to make me feel guilty and you supported me. But other people, they attack me and they try to make me feel guilty when I don't do what they want them, when I don't do what they want me to do. So actually, when you practice the truth, you actually stand out more, which is really what people want to do anyway. But to be like everybody else that projects, blames, and attacks, that doesn't make you special. For me to want her to do everything the way I want her to do it or attack her, that's not going to make me special. You know, I can give her candy on Valentine's Day and all that kind of stuff, but what she really wants is a man that's that loving every day. That's what would make me unique. So relationships become more or less child's play when you know the truth. They're only rough when you're practicing the ego stuff. So when I hear people talking about problems with relationships, even without them saying anything to me, I know what thought system they're using. They're still using the world's thought system in relationships, and they're doing it with somebody who believes in the world's thought system. And that's a very simple thought system. It's bargains made with guilt. In other words, you do what I want you to do, I do what you want me to do. If you don't do it, I'm going to make you feel guilty. If you don't do it, I'm not going to give you the love. It's a bargain. I love you as long as you love me. If you don't do it the way I want you to do it, I'm going to make you feel so guilty that you'll do it. That's the way the world does it. Anybody familiar with that? If you don't do what I want you to do, I'm going to let you know how unhappy I am with you for that. And you better, you know. And if I'm really special enough to you, guess what you're going to do? You're going to sacrifice. That's how, if I'm really special to you, and you really think I'm fulfilling your needs, you're going to advocate your need to meet my need. And that's the way the game is played. And then we call it love. And the Course says that's the most ludicrous idea of love that we could ever come up with, is that love is about you sacrificing your happiness. And when you hear it, it does sound crazy. I love you, so now you don't do what you want to no more. Okay? And it's about what I want. And if you don't do it, you are selfish. Check, now when you hear that sound, you can totally see the hole in it, right? But when you're in it, you don't see it. When you're in it, you really don't see it. You really don't see how a person who would ask you to sacrifice your happiness, they're the ones who are being the most selfish, but they're accusing you of being selfish. That's wild. I'm selfish because I won't do what you want me to do. That makes me a bad person because I won't advocate my needs for you. And then when you have sanity, you go, you know what? If I really loved you, I wouldn't ask you to. I wouldn't ask you to advocate your needs for me if I love you. So then you get to this point where you say, oh my God, I know the difference between love and fear now. Then you have to start making decisions based on that, and it's kind of scary at first because guess what? 99% of the people you know are using the old sacrifice thought system. So it looks like you're not going to have anybody, and you're going to be all alone because all you see is psychos and you don't want to join with none of them. Because you'll get to that point. You'll go, I don't care how good you look. I'm checking out your mind. I'm checking out your mind the way I used to check out your behind. You know, I've had a transformation. I bet you get to your behind, but I'm going to start with your mind. I used to work from up, down, up. Now I work from up, down. You know what I'm saying? So that's just being real. I mean, that's just being real. I just like to be real in my classes. You know, because I have a male body. And so I've gone through the whole male school. You want to know anything about the male ego? Ask us. See, I always tell my female friends, stop going to other women, talk about men. Ask men. You want to know about men? Ask men. Yeah. Don't go to a woman to figure out what men are about.
Or have a son.
I have a son. You know, that's how I grew up with four sisters and a mother. Growing up with four sisters and a mother gave me I had a close up view of the female and the female ego, and they would tell me stuff. Let me tell you about women. I didn't